From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Tonight, we look into the future at a hypothetical clarion call for energy independence that could galvanize the nation the way Sputnik once did. We're looking at a Manhattan Project-scale effort that could bring Americans pouring back into the sciences and give a huge new horizon to the U.S. economy, while at the same time helping the environment and disentangling the U.S. from the Middle East. 2 weeks ago, we had Nobel Prize-winning president of Caltech, David Baltimore, and other top science and technology leaders with us, describing what they see as the deep perils to the U.S. future and a crash project for energy independence as a potential solution. Days later, Tom Friedman of the New York Times argued for the same effort in a column headlined, "Fly Me to the Moon." Tonight, we'll brainstorm that vision with some of the country's leading thinkers in science, education, business, and energy policy. We'll take some leaps of faith, peer into the future, and see if, with some serious shaking up of the status quo, we couldn't map out a path that could restore the world-beating dynamism of American science and lift the whole world's fortunes. Tonight on Point, mobilizing a nation around energy independence. You can join the conversation tonight. Could an all-out national campaign for energy independence be the next Sputnik challenge, the next race to the moon, the engine of a scientific and economic American renaissance? And what would it take to make the U.S. energy independent? And what would the payoffs be? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Driggs, Idaho, is Leon Lederman, 1988 winner of the Nobel Prize in Physics. He was director of the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory from 1979 to 89. He's former president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and is founder of the Illinois Mathematics and Science Academy, which offers math, science, and technology enrichment programs for students and teachers. Leon Lederman, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
You're welcome, I think.
We'll see. We'll see. Also with us tonight from Snowmass, Colorado, is Amory Lovins, chief executive and founder of the Rocky Mountain Institute, an energy policy think tank. Newsweek has called him one of the Western world's most influential energy thinkers. His author, or co-author, of more than 30 books, his latest, funded in part by the Pentagon, is Winning the Oil Endgame. Amory Lovins, wonderful to have you. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
So here we are. You're both game to jump in on this. It really grows out of a conversation we had just a couple of weeks ago, where David Baltimore and Shirley Ann Jackson, who succeeded you, Leon Lederman, at the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and a top former Microsoft executive are with us. They were looking out on the dwindling flow of American scientists, the booming flow of science abroad, and saying this is headed toward a calamity. If we lose our lead, our edge in science, the economy, the standard of living, American leadership, it all goes down with us. And I said, can you imagine something that would turn this trend around, that would put a fire back under American science and through that the American economy? And what they pointed to was energy independence as the thing that could just do that. Leon Lederman, just for starters, do you share their sense of crisis around the future of American science and with that the economy? And do you think that this might be a kind of fire starter to get America back on the beam?
Before I give you a long-winded answer, you have experts here, and I'm not that kind of an expert. I'm a scientist, a physicist, and I do a lot of things on education. So what I'm telling you is newspaper readership knowledge.
But we really asked you just for that reason. You've got a big science vantage point here. Whether or not you've got the details, you spend a lot of time worrying about this.
Look, I do think there are all kinds of crises, and what looms to me as a major crisis, when you talk about energy independence, you're talking about some invention, some science, some technology, which will free us from the burden of paying whatever we pay, my $2.10 for oil, for gasoline, and so on. I think that's a noble ambition. I think it's worth. I agree. I enjoyed Tom's column in the New York Times about a project of that kind. On the other hand, I don't think you can do this seriously, unilaterally, as a nation trying to improve its economy and so on. I'm all for that. I'm all for
the effort.
for the effort. I'm all for the importance of engaging our people in science, especially our young people. We're falling behind. There are many, many problems that we'll suffer from if we don't re-energize our students, our young students, to be interested in math and science. But I think that it touches on problems which have to be global. They can't be something that we solve. To get rid of oil is a major problem, and it's a good thing to do, because whether it lasts 10 or 15 or 20 years, it's something like that, and then we have a real crisis.
So a world challenge that may take a world response. Nevertheless, you could harness American energies to that effort, or you could not do that.
I think you have to do that. You have to harness them, but you have to harness them in the sense of a global effort to solve problems of the melting of the ice caps, of the global warming, which is an indication that we're doing something terribly wrong.
So we get it. It's not 1962 or 63 anymore. This is not one country going to the moon. But if an American president stood up and said, we are going to make a crash, vast commitment to this.
Oh, boy.
As a scientist, do you see that pumping up American science and with it the American economy?
In spite of the fact that the context in which you mention it, it's very unlikely, but if that happened, that would be an incredible change and a wonderful thing to happen, that U.S. could and should be a leader in this effort to essentially save the world, because we are in terrible danger. And if we don't do something soon, the only advice I can give to your listeners is to teach your grandchildren how to swim.
So the Nobel Prize winner says, okay, it's a worthy goal, and we're heartened by that, so we'll keep on with our brainstorming here. Amy Lovins, let me just quote for all of us. This is John F. Kennedy, September 12, 1962, a different time, a different challenge, Sputnik, and a different goal. He said then, we choose to go to the moon in this decade and do other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. Amy Lovins, if we substituted energy independence for going to the moon, do you see that as a kind of rallying point for American energies and the U.S. economy, potentially in, the, I don't know, the decade or two ahead?
I think over the next few decades, the U.S. can get completely off oil at a profit led by business, and at the same time revitalize its industrial and rural economy and greatly improve our own and everyone else's security. I think we actually already have the science to do this, although a great deal more and better science can be developed. The technologies we need to do it already exist and are commercialized or being commercialized. The Apollo program or crash program or Manhattan Project metaphor, I don't think is a very apt one.
And why not?
Well, first of all, I don't think it can or should be centrally planned. In fact, our study, Winning the Oil Endgame, which is free from oilendgame.com, mm-hmm. Describes how to do this, built just around the competitive strategy business cases for four industries: cars, trucks, planes, and oil.
So this is not a bunch of government-paid scientists going off in the New Mexico desert?
No. And it's not about inventing something new, and we don't even know whether we can do it or how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
We have enough good ways to do it now, although we can probably find much better ones. And the real surprise to us, because no one had bothered to add this up before, is that saving half the oil costs $12 a barrel, substituting for the rest is robustly competitive with projected price, and that price is half what we've been paying recently. And in other words, it's cheaper to save and replace the oil than to buy the oil in the market, even if climate change and geopolitical rivalry and insecurity and all the other side effects of the oil were worth nothing.
Now,
it'd still be worthwhile.
I know you've got a specific program, and we'll come to it. I want to hear it. I'm sure there could be others as well. But one thing you said I'm curious about, you said the technology is already there. When David Baltimore raised this, along with Robert Herbold, who was a former COO of Microsoft, their notion was, as I heard them, that achieving this energy independence would require technological breakthroughs, and that engineering the science to accomplish that would be the kind of revitalizing activity for the country. Are you saying it's already there on the shelf? In that case, A, why aren't we doing it already? And B, would it really be so revitalizing if it's already been done?
A lot is on the shelf, and some is in the lab and moving toward the market. So we suggest some ways to accelerate that, not involving subsidies, mandates, taxes, or federal legislation, but ways to lubricate out market friction, use markets to do what they do well, get out of our own way, reward what we want, not the opposite. So it's a very light-handed kind of policy that would really be doable administratively or just at a state level. You don't need to go to the federal sausage factory.
And are you saying you don't even need a president to stand up JFK style and kind of light the Olympic torch for this effort?
You don't need it, although it would be a good idea. But just to pick an example, Boeing has already opted for efficiency as its strategy with the 787 Dreamliner compared to the Airbus choice of a Super Jumbo. I think Boeing will win. I think it was a very smart choice. If we have the truck and car makers do the same thing, we're over two-thirds of the way there. We are actually getting a very good response in those industries and the oil industry. Let me just put the car dilemma starkly, because that's where over half the growth in oil use comes from,
yeah,
is cars and light trucks. We all know about the competitive difficulties Detroit has. The big three together have less market capitalization than Toyota, and there's a reason for that. They have excellent skills but weak balance sheets. They can't afford to place multiple bets. And yet the competition is not just the Japanese and the Europeans and the Koreans. Next up is China. China announced in June that by 2010, there'll be major net exporters of cars. 3 weeks later, they announced a visionary energy policy based on strong energy efficiency and leapfrog technology. So they're not going to export your uncle's Buick. They're going to export cars that use a lot less oil. In fact, by then, many of our heavier cars won't even meet their efficiency standards and can't be sold in China.
So you're
saying
the
rest of the world's going.
So you're saying U.S. get up and get in gear, or you may be leapfrogged here around automobiles, a huge part of oil consumption. I want to keep the big...
And one in 10 private sector jobs.
Yeah.
And just to nail this down,
yeah,
we have a choice. Do we want in this country to import efficient cars to replace foreign oil, or to make efficient cars and import neither the oil nor the cars? There's
I think
a million jobs riding on that choice.
That's a million jobs and a pretty easy one to answer. Leon Lederman, let me ask you. You've worked for many years on trying to encourage science education and improve it. I know sometimes that must seem that it's gone at a glacial pace, and we've seen scores go down. America's relative standing in the sciences drop if you look at those scores. Can a project like this, could it really get the country revved up? Did previous big national efforts, goals, have that kind of impact?
Well, again, it depends on how you put it. I mean, I agree with everything Mr. Levin said, in the sense that efficiency is crucial in the use of energy.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you had a free energy, once upon a time, nuclear energy was going to be too cheap to meter.
Right.
That didn't quite happen, but that doesn't mean that we can't make technological, scientific progress in providing energy sources which are less expensive, but also more benign as far as environmental concerns. But I don't think you're going to get the American public excited by a statement of purely the economic advantages, although everyone agrees that's important. Jobs are important too. But I look at the change that we need, and again, bringing up China is a good example. We have, if you add India to this, we have 2 billion people that are emerging from poverty to what might be considered to be relative affluence. And again, each one of those, can you think of a billion Chinese driving SUVs, even if they're more efficient and they get 50 miles to the gallon or 60 miles to the gallon?
It just doesn't add up. Leon Lederman, please hold the phone. We've got to take a short break here. Amy Levins, I apologize, but we'll just be back in just a moment. We're brainstorming on energy independence tonight. You can join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're doing something a little different tonight. We are holding a kind of brainstorming session here on a big idea that is suddenly hot. That is, saving U.S. science, the U.S. economy, and maybe the planet with a crash program to achieve energy independence. You can join this brainstorming session tonight. What do you think? Could an all-out national campaign for energy independence be the next Sputnik-style challenge, the engine of a scientific and economic revival? What would it take to make the United States energy independent in 10 years, in 20 years? And what would the payoff of that effort be? Is it a goal that the nation could rally around, that you could rally to? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined tonight from Snowmass, Colorado, by Amory Lovins. He's chief executive and founder of the Rocky Mountain Institute, a very influential energy policy think tank there. From Driggs, Idaho, by Leon Lederman, 1988 winner of the Nobel Prize in Physics. He was director of the Fermi National Accelerator Lab from 79 to 89. He's former president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And we're joined right now from Boston by Paul Gompers. He's professor of business administration and director of research at Harvard Business School. He's co-author of The Money of Invention, How Venture Capital Creates New Wealth. Paul Gompers, thanks for being with us tonight.
Good evening, and thank you, Tom.
So I know you've seen this issue kind of rising. It's not the first time we're reminded that many years ago, 1973, after the Yom Kippur War began in the Middle East, President Nixon said, November 7th of that year, let us set as our national goal, in the spirit of Apollo, with the determination of the Manhattan Project, that by the end of this decade we will have developed the potential to meet our own energy needs. So we know the flag's been raised before, but the stakes just get higher. Leon Lederman and Amory Lovins are saying you won't do this as a Manhattan-style project. It's going to be, you know, more open and more loosely corralled than that. You know the business world well. Paul Gompers, as you look out at where that world stands now, the challenge of energy independence, the resources it would take, is this something you could see business jumping into, flocking to? What kind of leadership would it take?
So let me start by talking a little bit about where we are today and then sort of answer your question, because I actually do think that a Manhattan-style project in which the government would invest tremendous resources in basic science related to new energy and clean energy technologies would have the potential to both sort of save us from our dependency on oil, as well as create an economic engine that could create new jobs and new sectors. So if we look today, I study technology startups and innovation and venture capital, and if we've looked over the last 3 or 4 years, there are some promising signs. There are a number of energy-focused, clean energy-focused funds which have started. The amount of money flowing into energy-related startups, both fuel cells, batteries, solar, that's increased, and the trajectory is good. But if you look at it, across the entire venture capital sector, only about 2% of the capital being invested is going into these energy-related technologies.
Okay.
And there are a number of reasons for that.
Only 2% into the technologies that might really hold sort of the fate of the world in their hands.
Absolutely. And if you look, I mean, the one of the big drivers of startup and innovative activity in the venture capital sector is spending on basic science research. So if you look at where the venture capital sector has developed and technology startups have really flourished in Silicon Valley and here in Route 128, it's around the institutions where government funding of basic science research has really created intellectual capital and the feedstock for these ventures. And so when I look out and think about 10 years from now, how might we create a startup sector that looks and mimics the IT sector, or I may mimic the sort of biotechnology sector, really
except around energy technology, you mean?
Around energy technology, exactly. If we want that, I actually do think that we need to have a proactive government policy which is investing in the basic science to create those new technologies and those new ideas. I mean, the previous guests were clearly talking about things we can do to conserve oil, both in terms of automobiles and airplanes and the like, but if we really want to think about sort of energy independence and, quote, saving the world, we need to think about new technologies like fuel cells, like solar, that can really solve the problem, not for the next 20 years, but the next 100 years or next 200 years.
And if the government planted a flag there and put some money behind it, is this a place you'd see companies pouring in? Do you think that they could create, a kind of a whirlwind like we saw around IT in the last couple of decades?
I think absolutely. I mean, I think that when venture capitalists aren't going to fund the basic science. Venture capitalists want to come in and invest when they see markets develop. And clearly, with oil at $50 a barrel, with sort of the sort of direction that energy prices are likely to go in the future, there is a market opportunity here. But it really does require a proactive government policy investing in the basic science to create those new technologies and those new opportunities.
Okay, so we've got some basics laid out on the table here. It's a broad brush brainstorm we've got going. You've got three perspectives there, some intersection and some not. We want to hear from you listeners as well. Let's begin to do that. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Peter is calling from Weston, Massachusetts. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Hi. I run a small nonprofit that goes and builds windmills and biodigesters in developing countries. And
biodigesters, they would create energy from fermenting biomass?
Yeah, it produces methane from pig refuse or cow refuse. And frankly, I mean, there are lots of great technologies that are out there right now, but even if you took all of those technologies, our system is fundamentally designed wrong. I mean, I live in a house that's heated by oil that, like, if you wanted to, you couldn't make it passively solar or energy efficient. And I live in the Northeast, and it's cold. And, I mean, really, like, we have a long way to go.
Well, we're not talking about putting you out of your house or making everyone move to the South. I mean, wouldn't the idea be, Peter, to come up with, some conservation, as everybody here says, but also with technologies that would keep you warm in that house in the North?
Oh, I definitely agree that we need to come up with those technologies, but the technologies, even if I were to have, say, a fuel cell heating system, like right now what's out there compared to what you would need to retrofit existing structures it's just not compatible. We really have a long way to go before we're ready to step away from oil on a huge scale.
It wouldn't be easy, that's for sure. I guess that's why it gets compared here to a moonshot. Amy Lovins, not easy, but doable, you say.
I have sort of the opposite experience in that I grow bananas in my house at 7,100 feet in the Rockies where it can go to minus 47. And it's actually cheaper to build that way because super windows and super insulation cost less to put in than a heating system would. The good news is that only a tiny fraction of our oil use is going to heat buildings. The big ticket items are, of course, in transportation and some in industrial feedstocks and other industries, a little bit in buildings. Specifically, the total end use of oil going to buildings is, I believe, 8%. And mostly in the Northeast. So that's not trivial. And, you know, Peter, you probably have one of those difficult old houses that's hard to fix.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still a lot you can do to those cheaper than buying the oil.
And what about Paul Gomper's perspective, that he'd like to see big fundamental science investments by the U.S. government to trigger new significant technology breakthroughs, the kind that might keep Peter's house warm and spark a lot of economic activity?
Oh, I agree very much with the merits of that, not only in energy but in other areas. I was just saying that I don't think you need a bunch of fundamentally new inventions to solve the oil problem we've got at a profit. But I've strongly support, and not only as a recovering physicist, the merits of wise public investment in science and technology, and I think we're grossly underinvesting both in that and in science and technology education. And then with the new immigration restrictions, we're barring even many grad students who are already here from coming back in the country, and we're going to have a missing generation of science and technology graduates to drive that research.
Which is exactly why we're talking about this tonight, as a way of maybe kickstarting, blowing the doors off the way things are done. See what might be required, how they might be done if this was set as a big, serious
national goal. It already seems to me that lots of Americans are assuming that at some point we're going to come up with that kind of breakthrough alternate to energy, because it's hard to imagine the world otherwise. But we're looking at what it might take to really get it done. Marilyn's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Marilyn. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling because, first of all, I am very excited and have been for years, ever since I heard about the Rocky Mountain Institute, about the idea of, given what's happened to job outsourcing, et cetera, to start us off on a new venture in new industry, new technologies, a whole new economy based on energy independence. It's a win-win situation.
Let's go. You're on board. We've got it.
I have two big questions.
Okay.
Which I can state very briefly, but I would really love to hear an answer to them. The first is that we're really talking out of context, and that is our current administration, some people say went to war for oil. I'm not saying that. I don't know. But we're so focused on oil, and is there going to be the political will to do this? We also have a huge deficit we're talking about putting in.
Absolutely.
Rain. That's one.
Yep.
The second question is, when we talk about starting something new in the world, being a leader in the world, 20 or 30 years ago, China and India didn't have a dream of doing what we're talking about now, but they're catching up very fast. If we keep dragging our feet, couldn't they have a big jump on us?
Couldn't they do just what we're talking about and not the U.S., you're saying?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's exactly what China's doing. And on your first point, you may like to know that the Office of the Secretary of Defense co-sponsored our research for very good reasons, including liking neg emissions in the Gulf, mission unnecessary. We won't need the oil. We won't have to fight over the oil. You know, other countries won't think everything we do is about oil. We can treat countries with oil the same as countries without oil.
But Amy Lovins, Maryland's saying, for a second, let's get real about the current administration. President Bush has been very focused on oil.
That is the current administration.
And, of course, we're trying to look beyond that as well. But what about the question of political will to not do things in the same old way, do something different, even if it requires a kind of national restructuring around that goal? How would you get that kick-started?
May I jump in here?
Yes, please, Leon Letterman.
Something that's being left out,
yes,
which I think is very important. I do think it's a long-term point of view. You could do efficiency. You can help ourselves for 10, 20 years. But what you're forgetting is that every time we use energy, we produce waste products. We produce negative effects. The energy that's left over has to go somewhere. And the environmental factors are enormously important. And that's where I think Manhattan-type project to conserve energy and to use energy so efficiently and that we can prevent the kind of environmental disasters that are coming our way in a very, very rapid way. It's a nonlinear effect.
Well, let me ask you on that line then, to Marilyn's second question. We won't lose the first one, but to her second one, she's saying, what's going to guarantee U.S. leadership here? But you're saying earlier, Leon Letterman, maybe that's not so important. You get the same effect whether it's a global effort or maybe that's the only way, as long as the U.S. is fully engaged in it.
I think it's got to be fully engaged. I think the competitive effect is very positive. I mean, we love our competition. I mean, the professor across the hall is a competitor. Our universities compete. I think we want to compete, and I think our educational system is so disastrous. If you look at all the records, we're losing. Americans are not going into math and science. And as somebody mentioned, we were surviving on immigration, which has dropped dramatically over the last several decades.
That is immigrant scholars, immigrant researchers, yep.
Yeah, 60% of our graduate students were foreign, and that was very good. Half of them went home, half of them stayed here.
Yep.
Now it's down to 30%, and probably in the next year or so it'll be down to zero. We don't want them, apparently, and they don't want to come here anymore. And they also realize that they don't want to send us the brains, which they'll need themselves. So we have a major problem in our educational system.
But the result
that
of it
requires the President of the United States to take the leadership, as you say, in a kind of Manhattan Project, using energy, using environment, to change our educational system. A massive, massive job.
But that could be the spur in the sign to say, this is the goal, here's how we'll do it. Emory Levins, can you imagine this administration doing that? Or if not, how would another one get elected on a promise like this? John Kerry talked about this kind of thing, but it didn't set the world on fire.
Actually, both candidates said they were in favor of energy independence, loosely defined.
Easy to say, hard to do.
And both of them actually favor technological solutions. I think we're all kind of on the same page. What will really get their attention, although it would be too late for Detroit, is in a decade when we start buying our super-efficient cars at Walmart and they're really relabeled cars made in Shanghai, that's actually a realistic prospect, and those cars will use little oil, and soon after that, not much oil or no oil with fuel cells. But just to put numbers on what's needed, it's not very big numbers. We spend $18 billion every other month, every 2 months, importing oil. If we ran that out for 10 years, that's $180 billion. That would buy all the investments we need to retool the car, truck, and plane industries, and to build an advanced biofuels industry. And that's the industrial base we need to get completely off oil.
So it pays off. It pays for itself,
yeah,
in a way.
$180 billion would pay back about $150 billion every year. It's a terrific deal for the whole economy. And I think if political leaders call attention to it, that'll be great. But it could also happen bottom up in the market by shifting the kind of investment patterns that Paul Gompers referred to, just because of the handsome returns available.
Well, we're trying to call attention to it just here tonight. Paul Gompers, what about this issue of India and China potentially leapfrogging on such a vast horizon as this? Could we turn around if we don't get engaged in this and see, I don't know, the next great new energy source developed in a laboratory somewhere in outside of Shanghai?
Well, I think that clearly China in this area is a bigger threat. I think that when you look at leadership in say software technology, there's a big threat to the software industry and what's going on in India. But absolutely, if we don't take a proactive approach, whether it's Japan or China, I think that we do stand to miss out here. And I do think there are two critical elements of government policy that are important, the first of which is we've already mentioned, which is the funding of the basic science, that the private sector is just not going to fund that basic science. So we need more funding of the basic science. The second is a partnership between public and private money. I worked in the mid-90s evaluating the Advanced Technology Program, which funded technologies that had large public spillovers. And what the interesting thing in looking at the Advanced Technology Program in the Department of Commerce was that it was largely successful when government money was married to private sector venture capital investing.
Come back and look at that, Paul Gompers. Stand by. Amy Lovins, I know we have to let you go. We're so grateful to you for being with us tonight, Chief Executive and Founder of the Rocky Mountain Institute. Thank you very much for joining us this evening. We are talking about energy independence and whether that could be the key to a new age of American scientific and economic revival. Can we afford not to do this? And what about it? The question's there. Can anyone but a president lead such a campaign? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are holding a different kind of show tonight, a kind of brainstorming suggestion on a big idea that is suddenly hot, that is saving U.S. science, the economy, and maybe the planet, with a crash program to achieve energy independence. You can join this conversation tonight. You've been hearing what's out there, but also in terms of challenges, but also the opportunity could be huge, kind of a thing Americans like to do. What do you think? Does this sound like pie in the sky, like a pipe dream, or like salvation, like something Americans could actually achieve with enough effort? And are you ready to sign on for a new Manhattan Project, this time for energy independence? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight from Driggs, Idaho, by Leon Lederman, 1988 winner of the Nobel Prize in Physics. He was director of the Fermi National Accelerator Lab from 79 to 89, former president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Paul Gompers is with us from Harvard Business School. He's a professor there, co-author of The Money of Invention. And with us now from Houston, Texas, Richard Smalley, 1996 Nobel Prize winner in chemistry. He's professor of chemistry and physics and astronomy at Rice University. He's also the founding director of the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology. He's testified before Congress about energy policy. Richard Smalley, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be on.
And I have to say, it's a comment that you made to Robert Herbold, the former COO of Microsoft, who was our guest a couple of weeks ago, along with David Baltimore and Shirley Ann Jackson, that kind of got us rolling on this. Tom Friedman had a column on it the other day, and we started thinking, let's try and build a fire into this. Whether or not the White House is doing it right now, this looks important. You told Congress that this is just the kind of thing that Americans do. You said America, the land of technological optimists, the land of Thomas Edison, should take the lead. And you've got a particular nanotech suggestion. What's that look like, Richard Smalley?
Well, I think this is a tremendous opportunity as well as a tremendous challenge. I mean, after all, we're about peaking in our history of using oil as our energy source.
Sure feels that way.
And it certainly would be nice if we found a good answer for what comes next, to make sure that we have provided for the energy prosperity of not only ourselves, but show the way for the rest of this, nearly 7 billion people on the planet, to do this in an environmentally sound way. So I think this is a tremendously important thing to do, huge challenge, and a great opportunity for the United States.
You're bringing an offering to the table about one way to think about it that has been described as nano energy, just to get our brain cells working here. Along what lines? How would that work?
Well, my particular push has been with objects that would substantially help the electrical energy grid. In the future, a key feature being what we call the armchair quantum wire.
And how would that help the grid? You mean help energy distribution, make it more efficient? Is that the idea?
Well, there are two critical things we'd like to do for the electrical energy grid. One is to make long distance, very large magnitude electrical energy transport to be possible so that we can move hundreds of gigawatts of electrical power over thousands of miles from for example, vast solar farms in the western deserts up to the northeast, or from nuclear plants in some nuclear reservation, say up in Hanford, Washington, 1,000 miles away to users elsewhere.
That's an exciting idea. How would nanotechnology come in?
And so we have a new material called a Bucky tube, a carbon nanotube. It's only a nanometer in diameter, but extremely stiff, and magically has the new property of conducting electricity as a quantum light pipe. So these tubes are for electrons what a fiber optic is for photons, a transmission waveguide. And these tubes can be spun together into continuous fibers. And if we can learn how to make the tubes of the particular type that is the metallic conductor, we may very well find that we have a new wire, which is sort of like a fishing line, except that it has the electrical conductivity of copper, or perhaps greater.
Let me ask you, so that would move electricity around much more effectively. I don't hear it being engaged in the creation of energy.
Oh, no. So the main reason to push the electrical grid,
yes,
is to allow us to take a greater fraction of our total energy needs off of efficient electrical energy generators.
The kind of huge solar grid somewhere.
Nuclear and wind, biomass, and very remote sources.
So to turn those into practical, huge-scale sources of energy.
Right. And a second innovation of the electrical energy grid that would be magnificent if we can discover a way to do it would be local energy storage in your houses and small businesses, the equivalent of an uninterruptible power supply. But instead of the ones that we can buy now at Sears, for example, that will give you maybe a couple of minutes of running of your computer in between interruptions on the grid, how about a uninterruptible power supply that allow you to run your house for the next 12 to 24 hours? Something like 100 kilowatt hours of storage.
Sounds great to me. Let me ask you, if I may, Richard Smalley, do you feel, as out there on the cutting edge of research here, do you need a major national push to get this, to make this reality? Would it help to have a Manhattan-style project for your work?
Well, certainly it would. In fact, it's hard to imagine actually solving this problem without a major program like that. And even with it, I think we will actually be quite lucky to have a good answer to this problem within the next generation. This is a tremendous challenge.
So a grand-scale challenge, but the kind Americans have taken it before and could again. Richard Smalley, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Welcome.
Richard Smalley at Rice University. Let's get
if
some
I could jump in. Mr. Smalley has I wonder what his opinion is of Drexler's optimism on solar, nano solar cells that would pave cubic square miles of area and in some desert somewhere.
Ooh, I love it when scientists talk like that, but we have lost Professor Smalley at this point. We'll get you two together, and we're glad to hear the way the sparks fly. Let's get some callers. Alan is calling from Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Alan. You're on the air.
How are you?
Great, thanks.
I don't think this is a change of subject, but it's, I think, a prerequisite to getting into the scientific details and the details of what the government would need to commit itself to is to ensure that we have a government that is focused on the same reality that these problems exist in. And without disparaging those of religious faith, I think it is essential that whether we're religious or not, we're all looking at the same objective reality when we're deciding what is necessary for the long-term future. And I'm concerned that whether those who are running the Bush campaign or those who are following him ardently from the evangelistic community were thinking about this in so many words, many of them may have a different view of what the long-term future means.
So are you expressing skepticism that the American culture is still, a welcoming petri dish for this kind of effort, Alan?
Well, if people believe the long-term future is framed by a prophetic or apocalyptic vision, and that therefore the details of men's actions will not frame our fate, then people will not make the effort to take control of their fate. I think John Kennedy epitomized the notion of faith that we help ourselves, God helps us by helping ourselves.
A kind of humanist approach
work
to science.
Must be our own. But if you flip that around, I think some people in the evangelistic community believe that nothing man do can change what God wishes to have happen. Therefore, there's really no sense in making the effort or asking these hard questions.
Alan, that's clearly a huge contextual issue here. Leon Lederman, I wonder if you've run into that in your work with American education. Do you see America as still a hospitable culture for this kind of vast-scale scientific effort?
I think it is. I think it is, but it has to be. It has to be stirred up. By itself, it won't do much. There's a lot of discouragement in the scientific community about the, the local problems of funding and frustration that there's so much incredibly interesting science we can do that we're not able to do, and we've got to stir up. I really believe that fundamental new knowledge is needed because we have to find ways of producing energy which is benign to the environment. That's essential, and it's a world effort. We've got to be the leaders. We can be the leaders. But how do we do this? How do we stir this up with an educational system where, hundreds of brilliant kids are moldering in bad educational systems, and we're losing that opportunity? That's becomes like the GI Bill. The GI Bill is an incredible breakthrough.
Yeah.
And millions of kids went to college that never would have dreamed of going to college, and the nation prospered from that. We've got to find that energy and that enthusiasm, and it is a question of saving ourselves. I think we have to go out and do things because we've done this to our environment. Mm. We've changed the way the planet is working, and we've got to repair that.
So, but there's a chicken and egg issue you're pointing out here. How do you do it when it's not stirred up, when it's not revved up? And yet in some parts that scientific mindset is not. But I guess that would be the whole point here, is to set a giant goal and to just start turning the engine.
I think that's an important part of the whole problem. Yes, set a giant goal. Let us be the leader. Let us lead the rest of the world, because it is a world problem. We're forgetting about 5 billion people who've never heard a dial tone.
Right.
They're involved in this. Their lives
are. Sure they are. Sure they are. Let's get another call. Richard is calling from Manchester, New Hampshire. Hi, Richard. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Sure.
Hey, you know, what's the return on investment, and how are we going to develop an economy when we give it all away all the time?
What do you mean, give it all away exactly, Richard?
All right. For an example, integrated circuits. We developed and designed and we made these great factories that made integrated circuits, and we have almost – we haven't had a wafer fab come up in the United States in what, 5, maybe 8 years. They're in Japan. They're in Taiwan. They're in India.
So you're afraid if we make this revolutionary breakthrough, it will just go abroad and the U.S. will reap no benefit?
That's exactly what would happen unless we allow – it to be protected ad nauseam.
Yeah, yeah, but think on this scale for a second, Richard. Let me pick it up with Paul Gompers. But think on the scale that we've got a whole new energy basis. I mean, and United States scientific leadership, along with others, but scientific leadership in making it happen. Paul Gompers, presumably, before those new technologies flow offshore, or even if they do, the residue of economic benefit should be enormous to this country.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at companies, I mean, if we bring the semiconductor industry in it for a second, I mean, Intel and Texas Instruments and Motorola are all still making substantial amounts of money, even though a lot of the semiconductors are manufactured offshore. What we're talking about potentially is this virtuous cycle by creating, you know, we're creating academic jobs for people who want to do this type of research, and then creating industry jobs for people who can go off and sort of commercialize those technologies from the labs. And where it ends up being produced, as you said, Tom, maybe it's produced in the first generation here and then moves offshore, but the value of that economic benefit still accrues to American investors, American shareholders, and to those who decided to risk the capital investing at those early stages.
Paul, we've just got a couple of minutes left here. It's such a big, shining kind of dream. Who wouldn't want to see it happen? Who wouldn't want the benefits? Do you feel that kind of verve still in the American public, properly led, to get behind a goal like this, energy independence and everything that would flow from it?
Well, I think it does take leadership, and it takes somebody expressing a vision for an entire industry, and clearly some of that can come at a local level, at a state level, but fundamentally a project of this scale to not only save the U.S., but I think as the rest of the panelists have
in a way the world
really does take leadership at sort of a national and even an international level. We need a U.S. science policy here for clean energy that will promote both the basic science and the commercialization of that, and that is something that really does start with somebody like the president expressing a vision for what this might mean to the country and the entire world.
Well, who knows exactly when that will come, but there's no harm in getting a fire started and hoping that it rises high. I'm so grateful to both of you for being with us tonight. Paul Gompers at Harvard Business School, terrific to have you on board. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
And Leon Lederman, my friend, 1988 winner of the Nobel Prize in Physics, former director of the Fermi National Accelerator Lab, president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. We appreciate all the work you've done on education already, and we hope that something like this might take off. Love to talk with you again if we begin to see it happening. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jupp, Eileen Amada, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Rachel Dornhelm, Michael Garth, and Lauren Madelon. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.